From Fort Wayne, Indiana, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Dr. John Davis, Andrew Downs, Pat Miller, and in our second hour, U.S. Senator Dan Coats, Wynn Moses, and Ryan Recker. Our program tonight coming to you from our new home base in Indiana. It is the studios of WoWo Radio, 1190 AM and 92.3 FM, a federated media station in Fort Wayne, Indiana, the second largest city in the Hoosier State. If you have questions, you can email them to me at brucedumont@museum.tv. Questions via Twitter can go to us at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And if you want to watch the show on the replay on the web, you can go to beyondthebeltway.com, where you can listen and watch shows from the past. We have a full 2 hours, and again, we are in a terrific time. There's so much going on in the world, and we've got great guests for you tonight. We're going to be talking about what's happening in the Gaza Strip and Israel, and we're going to talk about Putin and Ukraine and what's happening on our borders. All of those subjects will be covered in the next 2 hours on the broadcast, and again, Senator Dan Coats will join us in the second hour for a portion of our broadcast. But I do want to begin by talking about basically the upstaging of our political discussion by what is on the front pages of the New York Times today. The New York Times, one of the country's most influential newspapers, in the lead editorial has said it is time to end the ban on marijuana at the federal level. They're picking up on things that have been happening in the states. 36 states have done something related to marijuana, including Colorado and Washington, that have legalized it, even recreational. Dr. John Davis, you are a doctor of divinity. I want to get your response to this urging now by one of the country's leading periodicals to suggest that it's time to give a serious discussion to legalizing marijuana. What's your reaction to that?
I'm concerned about that on a couple of grounds. Number one, we don't have a long history of state approval of this to know what the medical outcomes are going to be, what the practical aspects of that are going to be. Secondly, Colorado has already given indication that there's some criminal problems going to be associated with that. So I think I would hesitate to support that type of thing for the reasons I've stated.
Andrew Downs also joins us. Andrew, what's your reaction?
In the state of Indiana, we've actually had a couple of pieces of legislation introduced on a fairly regular basis to deal with this issue. Some of them, people would say, are a bit more common-sensible, for things like not prosecuting people who happen to have medical marijuana with them. Other legislation literally about legalizing or at least decriminalizing marijuana. None of that legislation's ever made it very far. So the voters, certainly the legislators in Indiana, haven't been interested in it. I don't know that the voters of Indiana would be likely to reward anybody for doing for passing that sort of legislation.
It is one of 14 states that has had no movement on this particular issue. Pat Miller also joins us, one of the country's leading talk show hosts in the afternoon here on WoWo. Are people calling in have people been calling in and talking about this subject in the past? Obviously, they will do it tomorrow, I'm sure, after our discussions this evening.
I would say in the past, yes, and especially around the time when Colorado adopted an open policy with regards to marijuana. But as Andy said, in Indiana, I don't know that that's huge. Are there marijuana users in Indiana? Absolutely. Are there people that would like to use it? Absolutely. But I also know an awful lot of people in the medical field in the state of Indiana that haven't come to grips yet and haven't come to a conclusion yet. Is it mind-altering? Does it function as a gateway? And I just think it's curious that we have so much political pressure to let's go ahead and get this thing legalized. At the same time, some of the same political people are saying, let's make sure we don't have too many sugary drinks. So I think it's kind of curious that people don't want you to have an extra 2 or 3 pounds, but they don't mind if you take something that might alter your ability to control yourself.
Well, one of the things that the Times talked about is the relationship between the war on drugs or the legalization of marijuana and what it's doing to our prisons, both at the state and federal level. They see a link there, which conceivably might have some appeal to fiscal conservatives, because there are some fiscal conservatives that look at it as a fiscal matter, and there are also some libertarian Republicans that see nothing wrong with legalizing it.
One of the impetuses for Colorado, for example, to adopt it was the economic factor. It does provide a revenue stream that's pretty attractive. My concern, however, I'd hate to see see us build all legislation on the basis of economic benefit to the state rather than moral, ethical, medical, other factors that should be brought in.
Is the public, when you look at it nationally, Andy, is the mood towards this type of change?
I think there are a couple of things to talk about here. Not only is there just the cost of incarcerating people for these sorts of offenses, and that's why you see some states moving to turning this into an infraction, but there is also a growing interest in sort of letting people do it. That's in part because there are a few generations of people who have used and maybe still use and saw no huge negative effects from it. But, you know, Pat's right. He brought up the question of medically, what do we really know about this yet? That's another factor to consider before we move too far forward. But you can find certainly a number of polls that say this is something that people want to see more and more.
Is this also part of maybe the fight to define the future of the Republican Party? Because this is an issue where there are some Democrats and there are some Libertarian Republicans that are on the same side. And so is this part of that fight for the control, the heart and mind of the Republican Party heading into 2016.
Don't know that it is singly the pinpoint of fight, but I will say, and you mentioned libertarian thought, that with the libertarians in the Republican Party and those that are libertarians separate from the Republican Party, I think that they view this issue as something that they need to get behind because it's something that neither party, the Republicans or the Democrats, have come out wholesale and supported it. And it seems like a very libertarian thing. I don't want to overgeneralize.
It's something that might have an appeal to a younger voter. And the Republicans, they are desperate to find a sector of the electorate that they have an opportunity to solicit for votes.
Well, I think that's true. But I think also an awful lot of people in the Republican Party would feel very grimaced if they felt like the party is going to take a stand on something like marijuana, where most of them would be opposed to it, and that they would do it, as Dr. John said, I'd hate to see us do it merely for financial reasons. I'd also hate to see us do it merely for electoral reasons.
Do you think it should be done, Andy? Do you think this is a good thing to happen leading into a presidential election? I think what the Times was suggesting today is that let the national debate begin, not only on radio programs like this, but in congressional campaigns and in presidential campaigns.
This is going to be one of those issues that is so low on the list of priorities for voters, I don't know that it's really going to mobilize many folks in any direction. And I think that's something that we have to keep in mind here. We also should be thinking about the fact that in a number of states, what they talked about doing was restructuring the criminal justice system in general, and this is only one part of it. Mm. So you could theoretically make an argument that might appeal to some younger voters in that broader context, talking about how to restructure criminal justice as opposed to focusing on this one issue.
Yeah, well, that's part of the appeal that Rand Paul may have in a Republican primary. And I think it's interesting that I think there probably should be further exploration of this, but I think it's too early to look at what's happening in Colorado and Washington and say, okay, let's change everything, because I think you need a little more time. Now, again, in time, they may be able to make a stronger case, both medically and also as it relates to crime. But certainly, thus far, they've made the case from a revenue perspective, and states are looking for revenue from every possible direction. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border tonight from Fort Wayne, Indiana. Bruce Dumont back live from Fort Wayne, Indiana. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. 1-800-723-8289. We'll take calls in just a moment. Another quick conversation about, because it's happening in Indiana and following up on another social issue or an issue that is somewhat combustible, and that is the issue of gay marriage in Indiana. A federal judge threw out the state ban on same-sex marriage, and then a few days later, an appeals judge judge, you know, put a stay on that, and now that's being adjudicated again. Bring us up to date on sort of where things are and sort of how people have reacted to that in the state, Andy.
What a lot of people might not realize is that in the last session of the General Assembly, there was an attempt to pass for the second time in a second consecutive elected General Assembly a bill that would have then put the matter before Hoosier voters to actually amend the Indiana Constitution to ban same-sex marriage and to not allow for legal recognition of similar sorts of things. The General Assembly chose to amend that, dropped the second half of it, and so that's where things stood. Now, that started the clock over again on amending the Constitution. Shortly after the session ended is when the ruling came down from the federal court judge. What a lot of people point out to people or seem to forget is that when we were talking about amending the Indiana Constitution, federal judges could have done whatever they wanted to at that point, even before that, I should point out. So there were some people who were not at all surprised by the fact that a federal court entered into the fray here. There seems to be a shift happening, and that's for more and more people to be willing to accept some sort of a recognition, if not full acceptance, of same-sex marriage. And that's here in Indiana, as well as nationwide.
But 10 states now have joined the Attorney General of Indiana in basically challenging the appeals court, basically saying, you know, keep the stay.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be a surprise for anyone when this ends up before the United States Supreme Court. The only question is what case is going to get there. And that's the way I've actually described it to students when they ask me about it.
Pat, is this an issue that people talk about much on your show?
Yeah, if I want to light up the phone lines, this is one that we'll go to. And I agree with Andy. This is going to make its way to the Supreme Court, and I think it needs to fast-track its way to the Supreme Court because, as we had a discussion, Bruce, a few weeks ago with David Long, who was president of the Indiana Senate, we had him on, and he said that he needed it to get to the Supreme Court because if we don't get it there and get something resolved soon— You have all of this. You have nothing but chaos in multiple states around the country. Mm-hmm. And so every state has judges flipping law and causing great havoc and people getting married. And then 3 days later, they can't. And people say they never should have.
And that's basically what happened because some people got married on the 25th of June. And
that's
then
what,
3 days later, the governor said he wasn't going to.
Right. And you know, a lot of this call is you have to be fair to us. Well, I personally am opposed to gay marriage. But let me just say this. It's unfair to let these people think that they've had an avenue to some kind of a relationship, and then it gets pulled away again. So let's get this thing settled. Let's get it down. Mm-hmm. Let's get it done. Actually, the Senate and the House should have allowed the people of the state of Indiana this year to have voted on it on the ballot, and they did not give them that chance.
And there are some people who argue part of what the General Assembly did was actually gave itself a reprieve. They didn't have to deal with the tough issue and actually were able to put it off for at least 2 years.
Yeah. From a theological perspective, Dr. Davis, your response to this as a theologian and also as someone interested in politics in the state of Indiana?
Well, from a theological standpoint and a biblical standpoint, I regard marriage of man and woman to be the standard. It's the cultural standard, certainly universally, over the years. And to go beyond that, I think, is to look to yourself for personal values rather than values beyond yourself in the scripture and in theological tradition.
Speaking of theological tradition and part of your tremendous pedigree is you are an architect, an archaeologist. You're an author. You're a pastor. You're a missionary. Once upon a time, you're even a baseball coach. But we're not talking about baseball. But I want to get your perspective as a theologian. When you look at what's happening in the Middle East, we see the horror of the ongoing hatred between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Is there ever going to be any resolution to that in anyone's lifetime who's listening to the broadcast tonight?
Well, the ground conditions that exist right now would produce the answer no. Because the positions are fixed, they're deep, they're emotional, and sometimes even irrational. I've lived with the Palestinians and worked with them, and I've been with the Israelis, and I've looked at it from the home, the personal side of it. I met with King Hussein some years ago when he was still alive, and we actually talked about these positions. A lot of folks don't realize, but King Hussein used to take helicopter trips to Tel Aviv. and have coffee with Israelis, and he had hoped that the border would have been open. He never wanted to fight the Six-Day War. He was pushed into that by the Syrians and the Egyptians. And I really think if King Hussein had been left to himself, there would have been an open border between Jordan and Israel, and you would not have, at least have that level of battle.
To what extent is religion at the center of that hatred?
Well, it's very deeply embedded. The Israelis feel that by covenant and by divine promise, that land belongs to them. They occupied it in 1405 B.C. They were on that land until the Babylonians drove them off in 586 B.C. So they have a long resident legacy there. They have the covenant promises to Isaac and his descendants, and therefore they feel they have that right to the land. On the other hand, the Palestinians, as Muslims conquered the land in the 7th century A.D., they've been occupiers of that territory. Jordan originally had the territory but gave it to the Palestinians. And so they feel they have a right to the land, both by history and by that declaration.
Andy, as it relates to U.S. foreign policy, is the United States acting wisely in trying to be neutral, at least trying to be neutral, in this particular situation, or do they have to really come down on the side of one side or the other? Again, most would say they'll come down on the side of Israel. But does the United States have to take a side in this, and would they be more effective if they did take a side and not pretend like they're neutral?
It's an interesting question. On the one hand, you're right. That if you ask most legislators, they'll say they're going to come down on the side of Israel over Palestine any or Palestinians any day of the week. If you look at public opinion polls, you'll find the same thing happening by a fairly wide margin. The problem is when you see people dying on a regular basis, you have to start asking whether or not the actions being taken by your ally or your friend are appropriate actions. And there does seem to be an interesting bit of a shift this time. There seems to be a greater thought that maybe Israel is being a bit too sharp, that maybe Israel is doing a little too much. You'll hear some people now who used to be very much pro Israel may be saying, hey, you've gone a little too far. It is a complicated issue. As Dr. John pointed out, this is not something that's going to end up getting resolved anytime soon, certainly not in the next couple of weeks. So sometimes what you have to do is go ahead and admit you are someone's friend, but at the same time be able to tell that friend, I think you're doing wrong in this situation.
Where do you think we would have the most influence, Pat Miller?
I think we had the most influence in making our position known that we stand by Israel, to make it known that it's not, although for some of us it would be, but that as a nation it's not for religious purpose, but we stand with them because they are our greatest ally in that part of the world. And most of the difficulties that we've had as a nation over the last decade and a half has originated in that part of the world. It's the part we fear most. It's the part that if anybody's going to come and cause us harm on our shores, it will come from there. One of the greatest allies that we have is Israel, but we seemingly right now are afraid to make that statement and to make that known. And I believe, and not to be overtly political, but I believe that when you view the last two times that the Prime Minister of Israel was at the White House, the reception and accord that he was given was far less than we should have given to the leader of a country that's one of our greatest allies. And I think it perhaps in some people's minds, both there and here, set the stage for what some people think is our perceived thought.
Dr. John.
One of the things I'm observing in terms of public opinion, I think in this conflict, we have seen more footage of agonizing Palestinians, mothers, babies. I watch Al Jazeera. I watch BBC. The slant is all the way to that direction. And if there's an Israeli position, it's a talking head of Benjamin Netanyahu or mm-hmm. somebody like that. Mm-hmm. Well, the contrast between the two is devastating. If you see a dead child in the mother's arms, and that's emotionally impacting, and a lot of opinion right now is guided by that, forgetting, of course, why all of this started. But
you're talking about the way the journalists are covering the story.
Right.
But in every fight, if there are cameras present, usually someone has thrown the first punch before the cameras start rolling. And then when the punch comes back, that's what people see. Isn't that what we're seeing here? I mean, we're not seeing, at least we're not seeing the human carnage that happens when Hamas is firing missiles into Israel.
Yeah, I find it curious.
And maybe the numbers are not. I mean, the numbers now are it's overwhelming. The over 1,000 Palestinians killed in the last 10 days.
Yeah, to piggyback on where Dr. John was, I do find it curious. There are far more permanent news agencies in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv than there are in Syria or in Lebanon or in all places Hamas. And yet, you see much more footage of Hamas. I don't see any cameras in Israel that are at a school that's been hit. I don't see reporters willing to stand at a place where they think missiles might come. So it's amazing to me, and it's very slanted. Where would we stand? We'll probably end up standing where the politicians sense the populace wants to be. Where will the populace be? I think it'll all be predicated on what it is that they see repeatedly.
Well, the populace certainly doesn't want to, at least the United States populace at the moment, they don't want to get involved anywhere. And I want to talk about that when we come back. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border every Sunday night now in our 34th year on the air. Tonight, live from Fort Wayne, Indiana. From New Haven, Connecticut to New Haven, Indiana, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8029. We are on the road this week, and we are at WoWo Radio. That is in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And if you are a radio historian, WoWo is really one of the classic radio stations in America. For many, many years, it's now owned by Federated Media. For many years, it was owned by Westinghouse. It was a 50,000-watt powerhouse that was responsible for a lot of things. In fact, the first basketball game ever on radio was done by this station. And again, it's a remarkable radio station, a great facility, and our thanks to everyone for making us feel very comfortable this week. I had a wonderful time last night, came in. You know that I love baseball. And again, congratulations to Frank Thomas of the White Sox and the entire inducting field today that were inducted into Cooperstown Baseball Hall of Fame. But last night, I went over to Parkview Field, which is the home of the Tin Caps, which is the Fort Wayne Midwest League team, and it has been voted the most beautiful minor league ballpark in America, and it was a spectacular experience. Great fireworks. The home team won, and it was a great time. So, again, it's nice to be in Fort Wayne, Indiana tonight and under the good graces of WoWo Radio. Joining us around the table this evening, we have Pat Miller. He is a radio talk show host here at WoWo since 1999 from Indianapolis, Indiana. That's where he was born. He's also in the insurance and financial advisory field, but again, he's immensely popular in the afternoons here on WoWo. Andrew Downs joins us. He is an associate professor and director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics. That's at Indiana University, Purdue University, located here in Fort Wayne, and that is the first such center in America focusing on one state's political history. And the Downs Center is named after Andy's father, Mike Downs, who was a professor for many years at that university and also was a political advisor. And when he passed away several years ago, his friends decided, what can we do to really honor the man, not only the professor, but the man who loved politics? And it really is a great lasting memory in your dad's name that you are now the director of that center. So congratulations to you. Again, it's a good way to remember people around the country. If you're trying to come up with something to do when a loved one passes, you might want to take some advice, at least what the family and friends of Mike Downs did. Dr. John Davis also joins us. He is a Doctor of Divinity. He is the former president and professor emeritus at Grace Theological Seminary in Winona, Indiana. He is an archaeologist, an author, a pastor, a missionary, a musician, an outdoorsman, and a former baseball coach. You've got many, many hats that you wear. Let's head to the phone calls. Let's go to Steve listening to us on WNTK in New Hampshire. That's one of our oldest affiliates. Nice to have you with us, Steve.
It's so old, you almost have trouble remembering where it was. Yeah, thanks. And another great show.
Thank you.
And actually, you mentioned WoWo Radio, and if they carried the Fort Wayne Pistons back then, I think I used to listen. I mean, growing up in New York,
I think you're right, because, again, in that day, they were 50,000 watts. I used to listen to them growing up in Chicago many years ago.
So, as always, a great show. And just a few comments, and then I'd love to hear the responses. Mm-hmm. One is on the marijuana initiative discussed today in the New York Times. One of the speakers, I don't know which one, mentioned it, well, until studies are done with gateway drugs and so on. The reality is that many people who start with marijuana do go and use harder drugs. That doesn't mean everybody who starts marijuana. There's only a very small percentage. And those people who would use heroin and cocaine, et cetera, probably would use it if marijuana was or was not available. And, in fact, because it's illegal, may very well bring people into contact with people who are not only selling marijuana but are selling harder drugs. And until we then get rid of the hypocrisy and of, you know, why are we selling beer? Beer could be a gateway for hard liquor. Mm-hmm. And clearly we know the medical effects of alcoholism, not minor drinking, but alcoholism. So it is a hypocrisy.
Well,
there.
We seem to understand, and as I understand it within the scientific community, there isn't a lot of disagreement on what I'm about to say, and that is the effect of marijuana on an adolescent brain is pretty damaging. So the question would be, in the sake of, you know, public policy and maybe following the crowd and changing in attitudes, does the government sanction something that they know that can have some effect on an adolescent brain? Andy?
In Indiana, in each county, there's something called a local coordinating council that actually gets revenue from DUI and OWI-type offenses. Mm-hmm. That money is then used for three purposes. It's used for education and prevention, it's used for treatment, and it's used for criminal justice, focused on the use of and misuse of drugs and alcohol. They start from the premise that young folks who do end up using marijuana, they see that as a gateway, in part because, as you just pointed out, that has some negative effects on the developing brain. They also think that it's just a gateway more generally for other users, for adults, et cetera. But in Indiana, there is a concerted effort in all 92 counties to actually prevent the initial use of that, not only because it is illegal, but also because of the negative health ramifications.
Okay, thanks very much. I want to go back to our discussion of the Middle East. And Dr. Davis, you're because you've been there so often, and this is something that I don't hear a lot of discussions, with all of the warring that has been going on there for hundreds of years now, who will the Palestinians listen to if they don't trust and don't believe the United States is a fair negotiator in their relations? Is there any other political power in the region, whether it's the Saudis, whether it's any one of the oil-rich nations, whether it's the Egyptians? Is there anybody that can pick up the phone and talk to the leadership of Hamas and say, stop it? Because someone has got to stop first. Because if someone stops, the other guy can really look like the bad guy. Nobody wants to stop here.
Actually, my answer may seem to surprise you, but I really think the United States is still the broker. And here's the reason. The Russians have tried their entree into the area. They've supplied arms. And most of the interest of these other nations has been highly parochial and military. They've supplied military goods and things of that nature. But they have not shown a commitment to the long-range culture of the area and the peace of the area. The United States, I think, has established itself, at least with moral credibility, and the Arabs that I know still respect the United States. They're concerned about its commitment to Israel, but Jordanian Arabs for years were very favorable to the United States, and I think the U.S. could have been a broker during those years. Now things are heated to the level I'm not sure that'd be the case. I don't know who else you would go to. The colonial powers are hated by the Arabs, the British, the French, and so forth. Mm-hmm. They carved up all the territory.
Right. And even more so than the United States.
Exactly. And so I think that the U.S. in different situations and conditions still could play a critical role in building a peace treaty for the area.
Another hot spot, but again tied to what's happening in Ukraine and the expansionism of Russia and Putin. Has Putin outsmarted Barack Obama, in your view, Pat?
Doesn't have to. Barack Obama has outsmarted himself. Because,
in what way?
Well, you know, take our relationship with Syria. You draw a line in the sand, and then you act like it's not there. You tell friends that we will be there for them, and then we're not. There are things that we could do right now with regard to Ukraine other than just pushing Putin in the face, but we should be giving genuine aid, and I don't mean boots on ground, but we should be giving genuine aid to the Ukrainians, which we are really are not. We should reestablish
arming them.
Yes, and re-strengthening our positions in Eastern Europe. Because in my view, and I may be the only guy on the planet here tonight that thinks this, but in my view, if this is not resolved in some way, matter, shape, or form very soon, what you saw Putin do with Eastern Ukraine, you're going to see him try to do other things to reconstitute other nations in Eastern Europe. And I have some friends and people that I am in contact with in a lot of the Slavic countries, and they're very concerned. They're extremely concerned. And they don't see the U.S. giving a whole lot of help to Ukraine, which we promised them we would do, by the way. You know, that if they would not go nuclear or go crazy or anything, we will stand there with you. And I don't see us standing.
Do you think we're perceived as weak in the world now, Andy?
I think in some categories or in some quarters, yes, that's probably true.
But I want to go back to what
Pat was talking about. While I think there are probably some genuine concerns about Putin expanding, let's also keep in mind that every time he expands, part of what he does is he makes promises to the folks in that area about social support network as well as economic development and other sorts of things. The Russian economy, although not in awful shape, I'm not sure that it can survive too much of an expansion. So there are some folks who study this area who believe that he may have actually overstepped his boundaries a little bit here, or what he can accomplish. Because once the folks in Crimea specifically, but beyond there, begin to ask for what he has promised them, he may have trouble actually following through on that promise.
Is he smart? Is he outsmarting the rest of the world, John?
Not really, but he's taken his clue from some of the moves we made. When we moved the defensive missile systems from Poland in that area, that sent a signal to Putin that we were in some form of retreat and not quite as committed to that particular area. And I think he's moving with that in mind. And we do need, as has already been said, to support the folks in Ukraine with the promises that we already made some years ago, as a matter of fact.
And I think that we were talking earlier about the Middle East and about Israel and those. I think that's why, yes, the U.S. probably should be the one to broker the deals, but are we weakened in our position to do it? Yes, because they've seen us function or not function in Ukraine, and they've seen us not be able to handle the Putin question very well. And so on both sides of the Israeli problem, I think they're probably thinking we may not either have the impetus to do it or we may not no longer have the ability.
Well, every enemy of the United States likes to test the will of the American president, and certainly we're being tested in a number of areas around the world at this particular moment. 1-800-723-8029. Thank you very much for joining us. Wherever you're listening, from coast to coast, it's nice to have you with us tonight. From Fort Wayne, Indiana. Bruce Dumont back from WoWo Radio in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Nice to have you with us tonight. 1-800-723-8029. Another issue that I want to discuss in this remaining segment of our number one, and that is the issue of the influx of illegal children and women, and now I guess some men as well from Central America. President Obama met with some of the leaders of those regions, suggesting that there be some form of screening that takes place in those countries. Where those seeking refuge will really have a place locally to do it. Is this a day late and a dollar short with this concept, Pat?
I think it is. And with the problem that we're having with everything that's happening at the border, you know, if you're in a triage unit, if you've been in a horrible accident and you're bleeding, you may end up needing surgery. You may end up needing other kind of medical care. But you need to stop the bleeding first. If we don't close the border, we're just teasing ourselves. When Ronald Reagan gave in to amnesty years ago, it was all going to be taken care of. It wasn't, and here we are again, only instead of talking about 3.5 million, now we're talking about 12 up to 15 million.
I think it's important that you mention Ronald Reagan, because this really is a bipartisan mess.
Yes.
The mess we have is, you know, they talk about why can't the parties get together to correct it?
Yep.
Both parties created this mess.
Well, yeah, and both parties need to stop worrying about who's going to vote for them out of a certain minority, and they just need to get around to doing
don't
the things.
Don't hold your breath for that.
Yeah, but if we don't take care of the border, I mean, if we don't absolutely take care of the border, as I heard someone say the other day, if a nation without a border is not a nation. If you don't preserve who and what you are, you know, here's what I need. I need people who come here illegally and they think that that's okay, and those that think it's okay, I need them to go with me to Margate, Florida, because my father, who was born just outside of Dublin, Ireland, who on his own dime made two trips over to come over here to secure a job, then go back home, get on the list, stand in line, paid his own way back through, paid to be certified, took the oath, became a U.S. citizen, and then served his country. I'd like for them to meet me in Margate, Florida, at his tombstone and apologize to him for being such an idiot because he did it the right way. I just have difficulty that if people's first meeting with us is illegal, I have a problem with it. And I have, and more than them is the problem of those that endorse what they do.
Andy, do you agree with the passion that we just heard from Pat, that one of the reasons why so many Americans are so exercised about this is because their ancestries did it the right way? And Americans don't like people who sneak in line. These people are sneaking in line, and the first thing that you've got to just put in there is they're breaking our laws, period.
We can also keep in mind, though, that a number of us trace our lineage back far enough that there basically were no rules for getting here. So
right.
There are plenty of people who can make that argument as well. We do not like it when people break rules. We do not like it when they break laws. We have them for a reason. What I wonder about, though, are two things. First of all, if we are going to try and secure the border, my question always is how. That's an awfully long border or borders. We should be talking about all of them. But then also, what we do know is that in terms of economic conditions, when the economy gets better in other countries, we see fewer people coming into the United States. We've seen that time and time again over the years. This is a bit of an argument for providing economic support to other countries as part of that securing of the border that Pat talked about.
John, what could we do as a missionary? You were once upon a time a missionary, and you've spent some time in El Salvador and Honduras. What could we do as a nation now, working with the nations there and maybe some of the nonprofit social agencies that are their job is to help people in trouble and to stop humanitarian crisis from happening? What could we be doing in a more aggressive way to stop the stem of these students coming here, or not students, but young people?
Well, there are a number of things. Of course, missionary agencies are doing a lot to bring medical care to the folks there, to bring food and things of that nature. The problem exists at several levels. One is just the endemic corruption in the governments of that area. It's very difficult for American diplomats to go over there and to really feel secure that the $50 million you gave them are going to go anywhere except in the right. pockets of government yeah. officials. So that's one of the major problems right there. And I was interested when these young people were interviewed as to why they came, the 60,000 kids. 80% of them said they came because they were convinced they could become a part of America. They didn't talk about that they were being threatened by the criminals, or none of that showed up except in a very small percentage of them. So a couple of years ago, it was only 13,000. Now we're up to 60,000. What made the difference in 1 or 2 years? And I suspect that we've given indications that things are open. If you'll just do this, it will work. And the question is, can we secure the border? Well, absolutely.
The cartels also understood there was business here. There was money to be made.
Yep. Sure.
Many of the leaders of the cartels were initially deported by the Obama administration because their record of deportation was very, very high. You can't challenge them on that. And many of these gang leaders went back to El Salvador primarily, and they are now they're now out. They're the pimps that are out now looking for the kids and charging their parents money to come to the United States with a promise that everything is going to be hunky dory when they get here.
I refuse to believe that our country, with its military capability, its technology, and all of that, can't secure a border. I find that very difficult to believe, that the sophistication of our technical culture and the military cannot secure
it. Is it a good idea? Governor Perry wants to put 1,000 National Guards troops. Will it make any difference, or is it an important picture and show of force that needs to be seen in Central America?
It's a visual and probably not a whole lot more than that.
But is the visual important, perhaps?
Usually is.
All right. On that note, in hour number one, I want to thank Pat Miller, afternoon talk show host on WoWo. Pat, thanks very much for being with us
thank
in
you,
hour
sir.
Number one. And also Andrew Downs. He is the associate professor and director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Indiana University, Purdue University in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And John Davis, you're going to stick with us in the second hour. We're also going to be joined by United States Senator Dan Coats and also the former mayor of Fort Wayne, Indiana, Wynn Moses, as well as Ryan Recker from WoWo Radio as well. Again, from coast to coast and border to border, this is Beyond the Beltway. Another full hour coming up live from Fort Wayne, Indiana. Live from Fort Wayne, Indiana, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. In this hour, featuring commentary by United States Senator Dan Coats, former mayor of Fort Wayne, Indiana, Wynn Moses, and Dr. John Davis from Grace Theological Seminary, as well as program director Ryan Recker from WoWo Radio here in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Nice to have you with us. 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number, 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. And if you'd like to send us a tweet, it's @Dumo. And again, it's nice to be with us this evening from our great studios, WoWo, in Fort Wayne, Indiana, which once upon a time was represented in Congress by our first guest in the second hour, and that is the Honorable Dan Coats, Senior Senator from the great state of Indiana. Senator, nice to have you with us on Beyond the Beltway this evening.
Well, thank you for the invitation. Being from Fort Wayne, we're all happy that you chose Fort Wayne to do the broadcast.
Well, it's been a great visit so far. And before we get to international affairs, and specifically I want to talk about Ukraine and Putin and some of the things you've said about what's happening with Putin, but I do want to get your response to the New York Times lead editorial today suggesting that it is time for the federal government to really erase its ban and end the ban on marijuana at the federal level. Is that something that deserves study, and could you support it?
Do you want to be on the air?
Well, I don't think it's time to do that. I think it deserves study, but frankly, the studies have already been there. It is a gateway drug. It is not just simply something that's, don't have to worry about the consequences. It is yet, I think, one more step away from responsible living that causes people to do things they probably don't want to do. I just don't think, it's listed under the federal government as a drug, dangerous drug, and it's not approved. Some states have taken some steps forward. At the very least, I think we ought to look at what the consequences are. Apparently, we have some trials out there now in California and Washington State, and let's see what the results are. Starting off, they aren't so good.
I want to talk about one of your major areas of expertise, and that is you're a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Your interest in foreign affairs goes way back. You were also a longtime United States Senator, but also the ambassador to Germany. And one of the frustrations that many Americans have in the wake of the recent Russian expansionism is that Germany, as one of our major allies, Germany has been less than enthusiastic in responding to what we've asked them to do. Take us inside the mind of Angela Merkel, if you can, and tell us what is keeping her from being much more aggressive in trying to slap down the Russian bear.
We had a considerable interaction with Angela Merkel before she was elected chancellor and subsequent. Having grown up on the other side of the Iron Curtain, having seen the face of Russia and its totalitarian rule, stifling of independence and privacy, she gets it. She understands the Russian bear and what it's like, but she is caught in a position, I think, between her country's economy, the fact that she is part of a coalition government, which means that the leftist government and the conservative government essentially are sharing duties here. And so there has to be a lot of give and take. And then thirdly, there has been a reluctance on the part of the German people to get engaged ever since the end of World War II, unless the United States was leading the effort. Even then, they became engaged somewhat reluctantly, maybe providing some support, but not directly engaging. So that's where she is. She has said some tough things. I think we need to keep her in the loop because she knows Putin. She speaks fluent Russian. She's one of our entrees to Putin, and she's said some pretty harsh things about him, but yet Germany has not followed up with action. And, of course, that's not too far from where we are. Mm-hmm. Our president has said some tough stuff, but not followed up with action. And then finally, Germany is saying, well, look, if we go out on a limb, is there going to be anybody behind us? Are they going to be sawing the limb off? The United States hasn't exactly stepped up yet either.
Has the United States and has the Western alliance, has it been outsmarted by Vladimir Putin?
Oh, absolutely it has. We're playing defense on the West side, whether it's NATO or whether it's the EU or particular countries. Putin is a KGB guy who's a tough negotiator and someone who has seen a vacuum of leadership. And he's seen not only the United States, but Europe basically pretty tepid in terms of responding to things like this. And so he's taking advantage of it. And as one of my colleagues said, you know, Putin is playing chess and we're playing marbles. And I think that kind of sums up what we've seen here in the last several weeks and couple of months.
Last week on this program, we had Robert Pape from the University of Chicago, who's written a book on the subject of sanctions and why sanctions don't work. And with very few exceptions, South Africa being one of them, that historically sanctions have not worked, and yet administration and many of your colleagues in the United States Senate keep coming back to sanctions as a viable threat to Putin. Your reaction to that?
Well, we've made the decision we're not going to send armed forces into an aggressive action against the Russians, and that then ratchets you back down to something like sanctions. Sanctions usually have not worked because they're not applied quickly enough and strongly enough. They sort of gradually ease in. Now, what has been done so far is far too little to get Putin's attention, obviously. They have not gone after what really cripples Russia and what really puts the pressure on them, and that is going after their economy. And their exports of arms, their exports of oil and gas, their exports of energy, they're very dependent on that. They have a fragile economy. Any major disruption of any of those areas caused Russia major damage. But to date, it's been on mostly all words and very little action.
Based on what we've done and the action that has come from Putin by beefing up, at this very moment, beefing up Russian troops on the Ukraine, do you think Vladimir Putin will soon believe that he could get away with an invasion of Ukraine and a takeover of the entire country? Do you think that's on his possibility list?
It might be on his possibility list. I think he's probably looking more at eastern Ukraine, where there's a lot of Russian influence and a lot of Russian speakers and people who have basically traded and associated with Russia rather than the West. Europe has been reluctant to even consider adding Ukraine to the European Union, partly for that reason. I think Putin sees that. Now, whether he moves in and tries to take the whole country, I think, is a potential game changer. My view is that he probably doesn't want to do that, but he wants to slice off a major part, particularly Russian-speaking and Russian culture, part of Ukraine. And to date, he's been fairly successful because the response has been pretty weak.
Senator Dan Coats, thank you very much for being with us. I know you've got to get on to another engagement this evening, but I thank you very much for taking some time out of your Sunday evening schedule and joining us on Beyond the Beltway live from WoWo Radio in Fort Wayne tonight.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity, and we're glad you're in Fort Wayne broadcasting out of WoWo.
Very good. We'll have you on again in the future. That's Senior United States Senator from Indiana, Dan Coats, who was a congressman from this district and then went on twice to represent Indiana in the United States Senate. I'm Bruce Dumont, back with other guests when we continue from WoWo live from Fort Wayne, Indiana.
From Fresno, California to Terre Haute, Indiana, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. And joining us now, representing a Democratic perspective, is Wynn Moses. He is the former mayor of Fort Wayne from 1980 to 1987, former president of the city council, also a Democratic Indiana state representative from 92 to 2012. And in 2011, Moses participated in the famous legislative walkout of Democrats in Indiana over Republican efforts to limit term powers in Indiana and or union powers.
Right
in Indiana,
to work. And I'll be happy to talk about that.
Very
too.
Good. Nice to have you with us, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you.
Let me ask you this question, because we asked at the beginning of the program, we've asked everyone, because when the New York Times comes out with a lead editorial, it tends to start discussions whether they need to be started or not. But where do you come down on the legalization of marijuana? Is it time to look at what prohibition of marijuana has done to the country and throw it out the window?
I think the New York Times article was very dramatic, important, and timely. It's easy to say don't do these things, but if you're a mayor and if you're responsible for those streets, you have to handle it so that people are both comfortable and the long term is solved. We aren't doing that. The debate about this has some experiments going on in Colorado and Nevada and the rest, and we'll get some data, but I think it's important to examine it, because the amount of people we put in jail over this, it leaves us still with the same cost of these drugs, particularly marijuana, with an immense amount of people out selling it. It has filled up our prisons. In 1990, we had 10,000 people in Indiana prisons. In this year, it's almost 30,000. 50% of those are over marijuana, small charges. They've ruined people's lives. They've changed every facet of how these people can deal with their futures. Senator Coates, who's a dear friend, he's a wonderful guy. He represented the congressman. He was a congressman here while I was mayor, and we worked closely together. I recognize he says that's a gateway drug, and in some senses it is. But so is alcohol, and so is tobacco. And it's a little hard to say this one causes more. It's a health risk, there isn't any doubt, but it's less than tobacco. It's probably less than alcohol. It kills certainly less people than alcohol. There are reasons to look at this, and I think the New York Times article will start the nation doing that. And it was very hard as a mayor to take the priorities of the police department and say, I'm sorry, you got to go down and raid these houses and throw these kids in jail. We're talking about 15, 20-year-old kids that we put them in jail, and we wonder why they're immediately replaced, because there's no other way. There are no jobs.
From a political perspective, though, is this one of these issues that a Democratic president can't really do much with it? Because a Democrat does not want to be perceived as soft on drugs, especially when it is a commander-in-chief and a president who has admitted to be a recreational user of marijuana when he was a child, whereas a Republican might be able to get with it or bring the discussion, including many libertarian Republicans like a Rand Paul. He may be able to be in a better position to lead this discussion than Barack Obama, because Barack Obama and his attorney general would be a little... They would be fearful of the Democratic fallout.
Well, Lincoln was certain, or not Lincoln, but Nixon was certainly the best to open up China, and that's the same type of a principle. I'm not sure, though, that Barack Obama will lead this or will defeat it. There is kind of a wave coming across. I was shocked to read the New York Times this morning and say they have an endorsement to legalize it, not just to check whether it's medically okay, but this is rather dramatic. And when they have,
there clearly could have been a halfway point.
There could have been a halfway point. The president could have said much more. He could say less. He can't seem to make up his mind. Sometimes the states vote this in, and he says, I'm fending this in, and the federal anyway, and bring it. So there's a great deal of ambiguity.
He has said that he didn't think there was any difference. He thought that alcohol was far more dangerous than marijuana.
Well, there certainly are more deaths from alcohol than there are from marijuana.
And insofar as the other issues that we have been discussing this evening, if you walk down the street of Fort Wayne, and by the way, I did today. I'll tell that story in a little bit. Mm-hmm. But when you walk down the street, what national issues do people talk to you about? Do they come up and complain about what?
National issues actually aren't as prevalent as local issues. Maybe it's because I was a former mayor and a state representative.
Right.
Even if a congressman walked down, I'm sure they'd talk about Ukraine and immigration. Very little. Taxes, leave us alone, stay out of our lives, don't bother us. The immigration issues you talked about, the mayor of Fort Wayne doesn't hear too much about immigration. People are worried about their jobs. Are they going to have a future with them? Can they find a way to do things? How does Indiana
compare? But if you were the mayor, if you were the incumbent Democratic mayor of Fort Wayne today, it's possible that the Justice Department or the President of the United States would call you up and say, Mr. Mayor,
will you take 400 of these children and would you bring them to Fort Wayne to be housed? What would you say if that happened?
Well, my opinion on it is that I have a great deal of compassion for the kids, and I'm sorry they're going through this, but you have to enter legally, that we should not be making laws change so that we let them in where we didn't let others in. But Fort Wayne, I'm glad you asked that question, is unique. I mean, it's particularly forgiving. It's particularly compassionate. We brought in 800 Burmese. We brought in the Bosnians before. We are noted with our Catholic social services, and Jerry Henry Sr. was one, for welcoming these people and inculcating them into society. And that would probably be Fort Wayne's attitude, but we'd want to do it making sure that it was legal in the whole process, and it's not now.
John Davis continues to be with us. He was with us in hour number one. He is a Doctor of Divinity with Grace College Theological Seminary. And I want to get back to something we discussed very briefly in the last segment as it relates to the illegal immigration of the children out of Central America. Are the churches doing enough to provide some support for their own children in that part of the world?
They're very active, and I think that they are extending themselves as far as they possibly can. Of course, they depend on gifts from the United States and other more wealthy nations, but the church activities and the mission activities I'm familiar with are very sacrificial. They're very effective because they address every part of life, the education, the educational aspect of it, the food, the medical services. So from that standpoint, it's effective.
Would you say, and I'm not trying to start a religious war here, but would you say that the Catholic Church has done everything that it possibly can do? We certainly know what the Catholic Charities have been doing in the United States, but on the issue of birth control and contraception and the things that the Catholic Church stands for, I mean, what is so great about bringing children into the world that you can't take care of? And a lot of what's happening in Central America, that's exactly what we're dealing with. We're dealing with a result of families that don't stay together, not because they don't want to stand together, but there's too many children. There's too many poor people having too many children. And is that not a spinoff of Catholic teaching?
Well, that would be in part, but the Catholic Church, I think, does address that. And the families that I know down there in El Salvador and elsewhere, they're able to provide birth control by means that are supported by the church. And they do talk about family planning. They do teach about that. And from that standpoint, it's effective. I haven't been involved directly with the Catholic agencies down here. Right. I know a couple of them. But at least the ministries I know have been effective in family management as well as developing economic skills.
It seems to me that at this particular moment, since we're now in almost a month to 6 weeks of seeing these pictures of these kids and young women, mothers bringing their children and, again, putting them on the tops of boxcars and bringing them to the United States and paying thousands of dollars to the coyotes who have some links to the drug cartels and the national security that also possibly represents to us in addition to the social services. But it seems to me that conspicuous by his absence has been the Pope. This is a humanitarian issue that everyone understands is a humanitarian issue, and the Pope has not spoken out against this. The Pope should be there, in my view, saying something to the presidents of those Central American countries and to the church leaders in those Central American countries. He's not far. He doesn't come very far from their midst. He should be speaking about the importance of keeping families together and speaking out against some of the drug cartels. Are you surprised by that silence, either one of you?
I am to a degree because this is a large constituency for him in this region.
And he's got an opinion on everything else.
Right. Well, maybe it's a matter of timing. There may be an occasion when he will begin to speak out on it. But I, too, have been interested by his absence in the discussion so far.
When?
Pope is an interesting person. He's been far more open and conversant about issues than any Pope I've heard, and I'm not Catholic, in a long time. I think he probably will come to speak out to this, but we just have to let him do it in his own time. There have been many things I wish the Pope would speak out about in this life that he hasn't, and I hope he speaks to this one.
Well, I certainly hope so. But again, we talked about this last week on this program. I think that whether it is seeing the children and the carnage in the Middle East, or we're seeing the children, coming to the United States. I mean, we are building, it seems to me, a foreign policy based on the emotional response of seeing young children. And I don't know whether a great nation should be compassionate, but I don't think you necessarily could come up with significant policy that leads with emotion, not rational, well-thought-out policies.
One of the things I've been most surprised about over the years is how countries that are on our borders, Mexico, Guatemala, Salvador, have not been able to grow economically. I mean, we're the greatest economy and nation in the history of the world, and yet they have continued to be poor. Something in there has to change, and then we won't have these problems. They will stay there. When some of the manufacturing went down there, the immigration slowed down. When some of the drug traffic slows down, some of the immigration slows down, too. The real solution to this is to have a good economy in those countries and reduce the crime. Are we kind of not just the policeman of the world, but are we also the caretaker? The answer is we can't be.
And since we are also the largest market for drugs, illegal
True.
Drugs, again, it seems to me that those who are engaged in drugs are part of the problem, because if they were not partaking of the drugs, it would dry up a market. Now, you have some people, we've had a guest on this program, who feels very strongly that the war on drugs has been lost. He wants to end the war on drugs. I think that's something that needs to have serious discussion. But the reality is, in this particular case, we're the consumers. If the United States was not using the drugs that we used, then the drug cartel in Central and South America would be less effective than it is today. Back shortly from Fort Wayne. Bruce Dumont back tonight from WoWo Radio in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and that is the Federated Media radio station in this great city. It's the second largest city in Indiana, and it is also up for the coveted Marconi Award as the best media market radio station in America. And again, they've been very helpful on their visits here. And again, this afternoon, as I generally do when I go around to an affiliate market, I spend some time during the day talking to various people that I run into on the street, and I had a little lunch at Arby's, the local Arby's in downtown, and was taking the pulse of some people who I spoke with there, and one was a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat who didn't think that a Republican could cure any issue, but it was a good bipartisan mix. But everybody seemed to basically suggest that Washington is broken. They don't think Washington can be fixed. And it was also nice to run into Mr. Summers, who was actually someone who came into the restaurant as I was talking to others and recognized the voice and identified himself as a longtime listener to the show. So it's nice to meet fans face to face. But as people involved in the political process, when the issue of bipartisanship in the old days versus the bitterness that exists now, how bad is it right now?
It's
and
very
and
severe.
Is it going to get worse before it gets better?
It's very severe. It probably will get worse. This comes, believe it or not, from the redistricting more often than not. The districts were drawn for safe partisan positions, and either one side or the other is almost assured of, in fact, getting elected without having to worry about a general election. What that does is push the vote far to the left or far to the right, and so you tend to get very strong partisan individuals elected. They are often almost defeated if they go talk to someone on the other side, because it's a friendship that they don't their partisans don't want to see. When you go to downtown Fort Wayne, and when you walk through Arby's or the downtown, which is alive and going very,
very
well,
vibrant,
for a middle-sized city, we work hard to do it the best you can possibly do it. But when you go to talk to them, Washington does seem broken. I mean, they can't pass a budget. They're mad over this. They're mad over that. Nobody seems to work. They haven't passed any bills. It does not look like a place that you'd take something for serious consideration or in order to get through. Just the most basic things happen. Then they get mad at the president because he tries to do something. Then they start lawsuits against each other. It seems almost adolescent and infantile.
But one of the issues where there seems to be some bipartisan willingness to cooperate is on an issue that you referenced in response to the first question, and that is on prison reform, on some of these issues that really look at the incarceration that we have in the country and say, wait a minute, if you're a conservative Republican, you've got to look at our prison system and say it's every bit as bad as the welfare system. Mm-hmm. It's economically not making sense, let alone any bias that might exist over racial disparities.
That's absolutely true, and there is bipartisan support for it. But I think we question if there's bipartisan support, why don't we have bipartisan results? And that doesn't seem to be as frequent as the worry of it.
Some of the things are being done, but again, they're flying under the radar. They're not getting the exposure because the story that the national media is told. And they don't have to look far where the two sides are at each other's throats. But there are some things that are going through on prison reform that are making their way through the system.
Well, outside the Beltway here,
right?
We don't find that. I mean, we don't see it. I don't hear it. Mm-hmm. And after 20 years in the legislature, watching the prisons grow, full of mentally ill people, full of people arrested for some portions of marijuana, and just destroying many lives in the process, and not very well managed. I don't know about other states, but in Indiana, we've had some terrible difficulties with managing the growth of them. We would welcome any positive direction from Congress, and I think it does send some dollars from time to time. But I have to tell you, Bruce, it's not visible in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
John Davis, is it possible for a politician? And then I want to ask a former politician, but I want to ask you first. Is it possible for a politician to stand up and explain and educate his constituency about the wisdom of, let's just stick on the issue of prison reform, because we came out of a decade and a half when it was three strikes and you're out, and the Republican Party and many in the Democratic Party, they were fearful of being perceived as soft on crime. And so we come out almost a whole generation of throw away the key, lock them up and throw away the key. And we now have a situation where we have more people incarcerated than any other nation of the world, and we look at not only the way in which it has devastated lives. There's been very little reform. The recidivism rate, certainly at the state level, is really abominable. And yet we have issues of the disparity. Is there any politician that can stand up and survive and say, folks, we made a mistake for 12 years. We should not have put so many people away. Or would that person be left? Would they lose a primary?
I think it depends on how they present it. One of the things I'm concerned about as I hear public discussion of this and other things is the appalling ignorance of the issue. Either there are a few small sound bites that are used or that type of thing. And I look for politicians who are able to discuss things in depth, not from a political perspective,
right,
but from the functional reality of what's going on. And I think a lot of our legislators really need to spend time investigating these kinds of issues, not from a political posture, but from what can we do to resolve the issue. And you have to have the attitude, here are the Democrats, here are the Republicans, what can we do together? And it's a pronoun issue rather than we and so forth. When we get to the point that we look at an issue from all of its legitimate components and then we say together, what can we do, Democrat, Republican, to resolve this? Until that disposition is grown and until politicians or legislators really dive into an issue effectively and in detail, then I think they're not going to be credible when they speak to the issue.
Is that an opportunity for almost a third wave or a third, I don't want to say a third party because that's too difficult, but a third force in American politics win that would basically say, you know what, the people that are battling, some are left of center, some are right of center, you go off and play on the sidelines. We're going to carve out a constituency made up Republicans, Democrats, liberals, and conservatives. We're going to carve a constituency that plays between the 40-yard lines, and we're going to actually solve some problems. Have we reached a level where the voter frustration has got to that particular point?
No, and I'll tell you why. And your first question of can politicians speak lengthy and in depth about important but complex issues is very poignant, and that's very hard to do. The attention span of voters is quite short. The TV and radio tend to do things in 30 seconds. They often make up their minds that way. Will they, in fact, then go off and find a third party or a middle way? Organizationally, it's almost impossible to accomplish that. But more than that, we've driven people away from the polls. I mean, we have voter ID programs that say you can't vote. We don't provide the services that we used to. We change the times. And the result is we have very low participation because people don't think their vote counts. And politicians only want the people to vote who will vote for them. And if they can find a way...
Both parties.
Both parties, yes. I want to make that very clear. That's very clear. One party seems to be more in control of that now than others. But it's of both parties given a chance.
And they don't necessarily want the public really educated.
It is not to their advantage to be reelected to educate everybody. That's the unfortunate truth of American politics.
Do you agree with that, John?
I think that's a correct analysis. A lot of discussion is focused on what can I do or what will this mean to me in terms of reelection.
Mm-hmm. And in looking at, we talked earlier briefly in hour number one about the battle that is going on within the Republican Party between maybe three wings of the Republican Party: the Libertarians, the religious right, and the mm-hmm. Main Street or the Wall Street Republicans. And I'm wondering whether there's a similar split in the Democratic Party, or because Hillary Clinton apparently has a nomination locked up, if indeed she wants it. Is it going to make the Democratic Party stagnant in some way in the eyes of the voters because you're not likely to have the give and take and the robust rough and tumble primaries which have been part of the Democratic history over the years?
I've never seen a quiet Democratic primary, no matter who's running.
You might see one coming up.
Well, it depends on who you talk to. Some like Hillary, some do not. But the important part of this is Republicans, in part because of the policies of Barack Obama, have captured most legislatures and governorships. They own something like 36 states. They have more elected Republicans now than any time since 1928. Mm-hmm. And I suspect after this next election, it will increase, not decrease. So there's not much room on the Democratic side to have a whole lot of independent debate that is likely to be appealing. The Republicans are in an internal battle at this time. They've got all different wings, and we're getting close in some of these places to Lord Acton's absolute power corrupts absolutely, because sometimes they're passing laws just because they can, not because anybody likes them. And we have instances of that in Indiana with our education system, which takes a long time to go into. But voters picked a lady who had the most votes, more than the governor, and the Republicans then are trying to take all of her power away in the education department just because they can, not because there's been any upswing of people saying we got to change the voters' will.
Mm-hmm. And on that particular issue, because, mm-hmm. again, I don't want to completely dismiss what is happening in Indiana, bring us up to date on where the issue of Common Core is in this state.
Well, the issue of Common Core has been debated only once in election time, and that was in the last election, 2012. Mm-hmm. And we had a education director's name was Tony Bennett, who was very much in favor of moving ahead differently than Common Core, but setting things out, and had quite a change. He went to vouchers that freed up monies, changed the way in which the public funds were distributed. The public rose up and said, just out of nowhere, we don't want any of this. And much to his surprise and everybody else's, a teacher named Glenda Ritz just went to work and suddenly found herself moving forward, and she was elected. And they then now put together another group that says, well, we don't want Common Core. It's got Obama wrapped into it. So we're going to try to change this. And it is in utter chaos in Indiana right now.
I want to get John's reaction also. 1-800-723-8229 from coast to coast and border to border tonight from Fort Wayne, Indiana. WoWo is the place. Nice to have you with us. Bruce Dumont back in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Thank you very much for being with us tonight. And I want to play a little game here as we are in our final segment, and Ryan Recker joins us. He is the program director for WOWO and also is the afternoon or midday anchor for news. Ryan, thank you very much for being a great host this week for the show. But I'm going to bring you into playing this game because you're not originally from here. You're from Detroit.
That's correct.
And I'm from Chicago, and I've been around the block probably a few more times than you are. You're considerably younger than I am. But whenever I go to do a remote, I try to write down, what is my impression as someone who grew up in Illinois and Chicago? What is my impression when someone says Indiana to me? And here is my list, not necessarily in any particular order. Running, the sport of running, basketball, Bobby Knight, Dan Quayle, Birch Bayh, Evan Bayh, Vance Hartke, Steak and Shake, the Indy 500, John Dillinger, John Cougar Mellencamp, and David Letterman. What would you add to that list?
Notre Dame.
Okay.
Notre Dame was
conspicuous by my absence. Now, let me ask you, Mr. Mayor, of those names that I listed, now, again, I'm somebody from the outside. Is there anything on that list that you'd say, oh, forgive us, why does he think of that? Or is there something conspicuous by its absence other than Notre Dame?
Your list is very comprehensive. It shows that you've done some study into the history of this, too. There are other things. Probably not any more consequential than anything that you said. Notre Dame was the only one I had.
Would you add or subtract anything from that list?
Yeah,
you can't subtract it because it's my list. But would you add anything to it?
I wouldn't think of subtracting anything. I would add the lakes and recreation. We have 450 lakes here in northern Indiana, and it's a key recreational feature of that part of the state.
I also think of Indiana as a very politically stable state, a state of moderate Republicanism, although it's voted Democratic for Barack Obama twice. What am I missing about what happens here? You know, you're a Democrat.
Yes.
You're a Democrat.
It is a relatively stable. And it has tended to be in the middle, pretty much. I mean, moderate Democrats. That has changed as the rest of the nation has and moved right pretty far. But it's still stable in that sense. I mean, if you color this map, it's a map of the state of Indiana. It's principally red over almost all of it except some of the urban areas. We have good, solid government. We're happy with the status quo, unfortunately, more often than not. We are, in fact, below the national average as an income, but people don't seem to care enough to vote people in or out based on that. Economics is the bottom line of Indiana. We make things here. We bend metal. We manufacture. We put things on trains. And that has had its ups and downs, but it's
And you make
way
pills.
We make pills. We make, I should say, good pills, too. Lilly is one of our prime people, and they've been a tremendous asset, not just to Indianapolis, our capital city, but they've distributed monies throughout the state. So those are it's a place where people could come, live well. Fort Wayne is a three-time All-America city, and we're proud of it.
It was an All-America city when you were the mayor?
Yes. One time when I was mayor, it was also an All-America city when a fellow by the name of Paul Helmke was mayor, and another one now when Tom Henry is mayor.
Okay. And when you first came to this particular market, Ryan, what, again, other than Notre Dame, which you referenced, was this city, was living in Fort Wayne what you thought it would be? Is this market what you thought it would be?
I felt that this market felt a lot bigger than it was, and I say that because the other places I've lived at, we didn't really have the wide variety of things that were available in the city. We can go to a ball game any night we want to. We can go to a hockey game. We can go see the championship Mad Ants in town. There's all kinds of great sporting events, which I love. It takes about 15, 20 minutes, 30 minutes to maybe get anywhere you want in the area. I wasn't used to that. I thought normally you'd have to drive an hour and a half, 2 hours to a large city to see maybe a major sporting event. So when I first came in, I was thrilled with the amount of things that were able to that were happening here. Plus, being that I'm a radio guy, the call letters of WOWO, what a what a historic call letters. And then the power. You can talk to people that live in Florida that used to listen to WoWo growing up. Mm-hmm. So I had that, too, that had a great connection.
By the way, if people did not hear my reference to my visit last evening to the Parkview Field, which is where the Tin Caps play, that's the Midwest League team. Again, this is a beautiful ballpark. It is smack dab in the middle of downtown. It's not out in some cornfield somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's reminiscent of the Camden Yards insofar as just the way it's laid out. It's a beautiful place with a big convention center and obviously surrounded by a lot of hotels. Mm-hmm. So you're now that everyone at least in this room seems optimistic about the politics and the state and the stability of this state. I want to go back to something that we talked about at the very beginning, John Davis, and that is whether or not you are optimistic about the role of the United States in the future. Are our best days behind us?
They could be, but they shouldn't. I think we have in our country a robust and an effective educational system. We have economic challenges and problems. But I do think that we are capable of international leadership at a level that we enjoyed in the past. We don't have it now. I think we have slipped considerably in terms of our moral role and economic role in the country with a $17 trillion debt and $100-some trillion in unfunded liabilities. The world is looking at us with some real skepticism.
When do you think we have a bright future?
I do.
15 seconds on this one.
I do. We've got a great economy. It's the world's best. We have the main dollar, the currency. We have the highest, strongest military. We have the best education. We're going.
Okay, that was Win Moses, and he's been our Democrat. And John Davis, thank you very much for being with us. And Ryan Reckon, thank you very much as well. Ryan, we thank you very much for helping make this program possible this evening, as well as David Field, our producer. Mogan David, he's the chief engineer, and Jim Albire, who is the general manager. Thanks also to Todd Nebel back in Chicago for assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Fort Wayne, Indiana.